that have been passed that either are not being implemented or being implemented differently or on a different schedule than the legislature had indicated. And I'm sure we'll have more than Ryan Osberg, Jeff Schiff, and Sharon Audio. So maybe if Assistant Commissioner Osberg wants to come up, and then he can bring to the table whoever he wants at various times during the discussion.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Brian Osberg, Assistant Commissioner of Healthcare, Department of Human Services. I want to address the issue that you have on your agenda regarding the verification of employer-sponsored insurance. Just remind the committee that one factor in determining eligibility for Minnesota Care is to whether or not the applicant has coverage through their employer. The idea, of course, is to make sure that we don't displace private coverage. So that requirement is still in law. That did not change in 2007. The amendment to 2007 that I think you're wanting to talk about eliminates some language in 2005 statute as to how we go about verifying ESI or employer-sponsored insurance. And it does, based on the fiscal note that was done at the time, it does imply that we would minimize, if not eliminate, verification of ESI. There have been some mitigating circumstances since that time that we brought to the attention of the chair back, I think, in the fall regarding our error rate around eligibility determination for Minnesota Care. One of the more significant reasons of our error rate in terms of accuracy of our eligibility determination is because we were not verifying employer-sponsored insurance when we should have been. The federal government now has potential sanctions in place. In fact, this fall, we will be going through a process called PERM, Payment Error Rate Measurement, whereby we could be subject to federal sanctions if we don't correct the ESI verification piece. The current law does not prohibit us from verifying ESI, and certainly does not take away that ESI criterion in terms of eligibility. What we did is we tried to minimize the impact on applicants and people enrolled in our program by verifying or ESI only when we think the situation may call for it. So we put into place a more limited ESI verification, and we're not verifying ESI across the board as we were before the 2007 amendment. So we have put in place a verification of ESI when we think that there's a good chance that the person may have access to employer-sponsored insurance. And that went into place just recently. So, Madam Chair, I would be glad to answer any questions you may have as to how we went about doing that.
Assistant Commissioner, about half the people in Minnesota Care are eligible for MA. And if they were in MA, they would have no employer-sponsored barrier, would they?
Madam Chair, if they were eligible for medical assistance, that is true. There is not a ESI verification for determining MA eligibility.
And there'd be no premium?
Madam Chair, if you're in medical assistance, there is no premium. That is correct.
And Assistant Commissioner, there's no cap on hospital payments?
Madam Chair, that is correct.
And so we're worried about an error rate with the federal government.
Madam Chair, yes, we are very much worried about an error rate relating to potential sanctions as relates to this. It's also an important policy. The issue around employer-sponsored insurance is aimed more towards people with higher income, not people who may be eligible for medical assistance. We're talking about the higher income scale of people in Minnesota Care who are more likely to have employer-sponsored insurance. So we think it's a good policy to make sure we don't displace private coverage. So it's important that we without making it real difficult, obviously, to apply for our programs. Thus, we have taken that form, the ESI verification form, off the application. We only send it out to those people that we think have a probability of being having access to employer-sponsored insurance. So we're trying to minimize.
So would any of those people be parents who would be eligible for medical assistance?
Madam Chair, it's possible, but less likely, because parents eligible for medical assistance are at 100% of FPG and under, and they do not have the $10,000 cap. They do have a nominal premium. That's true if they're on Minnesota Care. We're talking primarily of people who have higher income in Minnesota Care that may have access to employer-sponsored insurance.
But half the people in the program are eligible for medical assistance.
Madam Chair, that is probably not as high as it once was, but it's still a high number. You're right. I think my guess is that somewhere between 40 and 50% of people in Minnesota Care are eligible for general assistance, medical care, or for medical assistance, especially kids and parents to some degree.
Well, we didn't worry about this so much when we thought we were going to get Health Match any month now. But now that we think it probably will be very far into the future before we have it, we're worried more about it.
Well, Madam Chair, Health Match would not address this issue of verifying ESI with employers.
Health Match would get people who are eligible for MA into Health Match.
Madam Chair,
into
that is
MA.
Madam Chair, that's
and they wouldn't have all these barriers.
Madam Chair, you're correct about that.
Well, I just have one last thing to say about it, and that is that if you believed that the law we passed needed to be changed, it would seem to me the appropriate thing for you to do would be to bring it in the form of a bill and get it changed. What you have done is change by policy and then by forecast what was passed last session.
Madam Chair, was one option. We had the ability, the administrative discretion, to do what we did, and we thought it was in our best interest to do it when we did it. So we did not bring it to the legislature for a change. That's potentially one way of going about it, but we felt we had the ability and the obligation to do what we believe was correct, and that's why we put this policy in place.
And how much does it reduce what was forecasted in terms of enrollment?
Madam Chair, I'm going to ask Marie Zimmerman from our staff to speak to that.
Madam Chair and members, Marie Zimmerman, Department of Human Services. If you go by the full impact by fiscal 2011, average monthly enrollees reduced about 5,600.
And I might just add that it would seem particularly convenient to have that reduction in the healthcare access fund at this time. Are there other questions on this issue? Okay.
Madam Chair, then I would ask that Dr. Jeff Schiff come up and speak to the issue of family planning.
Madam Chair, my name is Jeff Schiff. I'm the medical director at the Department of Human Services. We were asked to address the issue of family planning rates going to providers in the family planning rate increase that was proposed and put into place last year. The the community clinic section was defined by the according to the MDH definition that does not exactly line up with the provider types that DHS uses. The bill analysis at that time and the fiscal note showed that these provider types, and noted that in writing that these provider types did not line up. Subsequently, this found that some clinics would not be available for this for this 25% increase. The clinics that specifically were concerned about this increase, two of them have become community clinics and are now eligible to bill as part of a more general system that was of Children's Hospital in Hennepin County, and are not currently eligible. The potential fixes for this would be to use statute language to redefine the clinics that are eligible for a 25% family planning increase, either to be nonprofit clinics or for all clinics.
And I think part of the confusion here is that the reason for the rate increase was to encourage people to fully implement the waiver, that people were actually losing money trying to provide the waivered services. So now there are some clinics that have the ability to provide family planning services under the waiver, and they have a rate increase and others don't. And that's because of the definition the department has.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it is because of the, I think it's because the statute language uses the MDH, the Department of Health statute, to define the clinic types that are eligible for the increase. And so it does not line up exactly with our provider types, and it also has some inconsistency in that the provider types that should go forward our concern is consistency across the system. So we should either the suggestion we would have would be either that all nonprofit provider types are eligible, or that the rate increase go for all family planning across all provider types.
So are there questions on this issue? All right, thank you.
Madam Chair, the other issue that you asked about was the outreach provision. Our manager in that area is not here right now, but let me explain. As we discussed the other day with you, where we are with that and how we ended up doing what we did. Last year, the legislature enacted provisions to expand greatly the outreach activities for people who are eligible for our programs. There are various aspects of that effort, and one of those was the idea of getting information, names, to health plans so that we can remind our current applicants, our current enrollees, that they may be up for renewal within 90 days and then 60 days. We had a issue around the ability to implement that 90-day and 60-day notice because of a systems issue. So we had that addressed and requested to change. However, so we opted to do instead is to test this model, to test whether or not informing people 90 days ahead and 60 days ahead would actually have an impact. We're in the process of finalizing that, if you will, that test as to what extent this can work effectively. In the meantime, we are seeking a change in our system so that we can automatically do this for all of our. We intend clearly to implement the law, but we want a systems change. We have to have a systems change so we can automatically trigger these 90-day and 60-day notices. That was what legislature asked us to do. We did that, as I said, in part because of that system's constraint, and we intend to bring the results of that test back, but we also intend, unless the law changes, to fully implement that statute.
And when would you be fully implementing it?
Madam Chair, that's a good question. I think we'll have to get back to you as to that. We'll get back to you after we talk to our systems people and today, this afternoon. I apologize.
So it's one of the things that you need to know about this area of the budget, and that is that generally you're legislating for things to happen maybe by the time your opponent is elected.
Madam Chair, I believe that covers the items you have for the health care area. I believe we have some issues that you want to discuss and other aspects.
Let me just check here. I guess I also have a question which relates somewhat to the budget, one of the budget recommendations. And it has to do with the proposal to take the children that were trying to move automatically from MA to Minnesota Care when their MA expires and to refinance that bridge time. You're familiar with that?
Madam Chair, I'm going to...
Part of your
budget. There's a refinancing of the general assistance medical care transition to MA. I think that's what you're referring to.
No.
That's you're referring to the transitional medical assistance program for kids.
Yes.
I want to ask Marie or to speak to that.
You might as well stay there, Assistant Commissioner Osberg. So the question really is, in my own mind, why do we need 2 to 3 months to bridge children when they are losing their eligibility from medical assistance and they would be going on to Minnesota Care? Why can't we process that application in a more timely fashion?
That's not a question for Ms. Zimmerman, Madam Chair. You're referring to why can't we process the application for the child who comes off medical assistance and goes on to Minnesota Care in a more timely fashion.
So we don't need to have this.
In fact, Madam Chair, we're getting to you a summary of all the things we're trying to do to mitigate against issues that you raised the other day, and that is what can we do until Health Match is developed to make sure that people are enrolled and an application is processed in a timely fashion for Minnesota Care especially. And that, certainly, that will happen. Some children will, when they go off medical assistance, will apply for Minnesota Care. And there's a process, that process will happen. What this current law did was provide 2 extra months of medical assistance coverage while that happened.
Right.
And so what we'll do is certainly, in fact, one of the things that we're going to address in our letter to you is something that we're doing to making sure that we are allowing or providing for more appropriate transfer of individuals from one program to the other on a timely fashion. And so we can describe what we're going to be doing in trying to expedite that process of those people who may be no longer eligible for one program but may be eligible for another, what we're doing to make sure that they're aware of that and that we would facilitate the processing of that transition. So we're preparing a memo for you to address the larger questions you raised the other day regarding the fact that a lot of people may be eligible for medical assistance who are on Minnesota Care today. So we can include that very specific response in that memo to you. You'll be getting that very soon.
Well, this, of course, is when they're going the other direction. And the law requires you to process applications in a 30-day period of time. I was just kind of thinking about that budget page, and I was thinking, so why does it take 2 to 3 months when a child is moving from one program to the other? And especially when we're waiving premiums for a period of time for them to go into the other program. And we know what their income is, because if we didn't know what their income was, we wouldn't be terminating them from medical assistance.
Madam Chair, we'll address that scenario in our memo to you.
All right. Senator Rosen?
Chair and Assistant Commissioner Osberg, my question actually revolves around three of these issues, but dealing with the chemical dependency issues and the treatment. You've got one here for the transfer of $2.5 million from the Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund to the General Fund. Then there's zeros after that. Then the restructuring of the methamphetamine funding, and then also freezing of the chemical dependency treatment rates. So can you give me an idea of what's happening to this whole issue?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, I'm going to defer to the people from our Chemical and Mental Health Administration who are here. John Sakel can come up and speak to those issues once they're up here next to discuss some of these other issues that the Chair has brought to our attention. So he will be here in a few minutes to respond to those as well.
So, are there other questions on this issue? Obviously, when we get this memo, we'll distribute it to everyone. But unfortunately, you won't be here to answer questions if we have questions about it at that time. So why don't we move on then?
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sharon Audio. I'm the Director of Adult Mental Health, and I'm here to respond to two questions regarding the compulsive gambling treatment program, and then I will be calling up John Sakel to address the issue with the children CTSS rate piece and to address your question, Senator Rosen, about the chemical health piece. I'd like to I believe there were two questions regarding the compulsive gambling treatment program. The first related to a study that was extended by the legislature last year for fiscal year 08. And I think it might be instructive to just give you a bit of history regarding this, because I think it answers the question about the time frame for that particular study, which I believe was a question. 7 months versus 12. The study was issued, we issued an RFP, the department did in 05, and what we were interested in is a number of questions that people have been interested in for some period of time around problem gambling. One was, what are the characteristics of people who are problem gamblers? And then secondly, the major question about, does gambling treatment work, and is it effective? And then, are there different types of treatment approaches that are more effective for different types of individuals? And this is the third study that the department has conducted to answer those questions. We issued a competitive RFP in 05, and that was awarded to the University of Minnesota for a 2-year period of time for a total of $200,000. Last year, the legislature extended that for $100,000 for fiscal year 07 to end in 6/30/08. The current contract ends May 30th, 08, so there's a 1-month difference between the end date. And the way the study is conducted, I think, will help kind of clarify the question. The researchers chose to do a longitudinal study that addresses data collection at the time of admission to the problem gambling programs, data at the time of discharge from those programs, and then at a 6-month and 12-month follow-up. The 6- and 12-month follow-up being really important to determine, does treatment work? Is there sustainability? Do people reduce their gambling? Because of that time frame, the data that we collected had to end in September of 07 in order for us to have 6-month data, which would be May or June or March or April of this month in order to complete the study. And we won't have 12-month data on the last cohort of people that we're collecting data on. Had we not completed the study, or had not the extension gone through, we would have had to have stopped the study much earlier and would not have been able to add additional people in September of 07, as well as have 12-month follow-up data. So I think the issue is the way in which the data is collected. We just received the interim final report. They're still collecting data for the 6-month follow-up on the last group of clients. The report is fairly comprehensive. Unfortunately, at this point, it still does not answer the questions about what treatment modality is more effective than others. Part of the difficulty that they're finding, and this has been true in the other studies, is that the 6-month follow-up has a good follow-up rate. But once you get to 12 months, they really lose a number of clients. And the total volume versus inpatient and outpatient was really quite low. The total number of people in the study was about 360, and the majority of those were in the inpatient setting. So to try and break it down by individual providers for the outpatient data was really very difficult, if not impossible, for them to do. Some of the providers were only able to add 10 clients over the course of that time into the study. So to disaggregate the data, I think it would not be particularly useful data. So that gives you a summary of the treatment program evaluation study. The final report is due in May, and it might be instructive if you so choose to have them come and present their findings to the committee.
Senator Pradner Solon.
Madam Chair, Ms. Audio, I find this really discouraging. I mean, we purposely put aside money last year so that a study could be done. The study was supposed to be instructive so we would understand what modalities of treatment would be the most effective. It was supposed to be helpful to the programs in identifying what treatment, what delivery was best for the better outcomes. And so I'm really discouraged, and I don't understand your explanation about why it had to be cut off after 7 months.
What I don't understand is why did the sample size have to be so small? Right. I mean, that seems to be sort of the crux of the problem.
Madam Chair and Senator Pradner-Solon, that was the recruitment. They recruited, I think, in the initial data or the interim report, they've recruited about 677 people to participate in the study. Some people dropped out of the study. Some people refused to participate. So the number then dropped down to the 300 that they could follow over that period of time of 6 months and 12 months to determine was there any effectiveness. I think the other thing that has hampered this study, which is not unique to Minnesota, is that the number of people who are coming forward for problem gambling treatment seems to be decreasing. And what we found even with the lottery, that there are less people who are buying lottery tickets, whether it's the economy that is impacting this or not. But the number of people who are seeking treatment seems to be decreasing. And we're doing, I think, a fair job of doing some public awareness.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pradner,
I couldn't disagree more on this issue. It isn't that there are less people seeking treatment. It's less funds in order to give treatment to those people, so they're not receiving the treatment they need. And in terms of the public awareness, I have heard complaints from every program that the material that is provided is too costly for the programs to be able to reproduce. I have a letter where some outreach was done, and this is just in my district, and one hospital asked for copies of material. They wanted, UMD wanted 3,500 brochures for their incoming freshmen, and one hospital wanted 400 brochures. Well, it was too costly for the program to be able to deliver. I don't understand why more money isn't going into treatment. This is coming from the gambling proceeds or from unclaimed prizes from the lottery proceeds. Mm-hmm. It's not like it's coming out of the human services budget or anything. I just don't understand why this isn't being distributed to the programs, why you can't facilitate more the outreach that they do and provide brochures that are less costly for them to disseminate, or why you can't even provide the brochures for them, that they have to copy them themselves.
Madam Chair, Senator Prentice-Solon, let me address the issue of treatment first and then the public awareness piece. You're correct that the funding for the problem gambling program has the majority of the funds have always come from the unclaimed prize funds of the lottery. And the lottery has been very generous, I think, in terms of supporting that program. We currently spend per year about $1 million for treatment. And these are for many people who have no source of income. And we're finding is that there are insurers who also do not cover problem gambling treatment, that it's still seen as experimental, that it's not one that is universally covered. The bulk of those funds are really it's sort of split, but a significant amount of that is for the inpatient program. And the inpatient program in Granite Falls, which is also part of a chemical health program, seems to be having the largest volume of clients at this particular point in time. But about 50% of our dollars, of the $1 million, is set aside for treatment. So we put most of the dollars that we receive for treatment because we really feel that that's important. We set aside $200,000 a year for public awareness. The current contractor has been very generous in terms of matching dollar for dollar pro bono work, so it really averages about $400,000 in total. Where those dollars have gone currently, and we would certainly be open to, if you feel that it's not being directed in the right place, what we have done currently is a couple of things. We have concerns about college students most particularly because what we're hearing is that's the group that is doing a lot of Texas Hold'em, a lot of other sorts of gambling programs. So a significant amount of those dollars, about $150,000, is going to provide public awareness information, websites, college student-specific information to a number of colleges and state junior colleges across the state. So we're trying to expand that. It started in Bemidji. It was very successful, and Minsky was very interested in proceeding with that. So we're doing some work with colleges and high school seniors. And then the other piece is toward adult services. And what we found the most effective public awareness statewide is doing public service announcements. Those are no longer free. So we set aside about $90,000 to do public awareness, public service announcements, and at that point is when we see an increase in referrals to our helpline and subsequent referrals to providers. We have set aside about $12,000 to provide for each of our treatment providers 25 copies of anything that we reproduce, as well as any new things like posters. We will give them one or two posters. If a hospital is interested, they can certainly contact us. We would not expect a provider to be making that kind of volume of brochures. So they, I don't believe, have contacted us for that information.
Senator Prentice-Solon.
Madam Chair, that was never offered as an option. The programs do the outreach, they do the public awareness. When they go out and speak, They can say, we were given 25 copies of two out of the five brochures you produce in a year. That's what they're given. And they're given four of 17 of the posters that you produce. That does not go very far. And it breaks their budget to try to come up with 3,500 or 400 brochures. And it was in it. And when they ask you for brochures, you don't give them to them. So for them to go and say, well, St. Mary's, you can go and ask the department for it, I mean, that's just, it doesn't make sense. They wouldn't even know that that was an option if you wouldn't give it to the program, who would be the intermediary here. And I'm also really, really discouraged about the research because, yes, you're right. The healthcare provider or the insurance companies don't pay for problem gambling treatment. And that's why the research is so essential, to find out that it is effective. And that's why the effort last year to develop this program to test it. And I'm not sure what we do now.
Madam Chair, Senator Pretner Sullivan, I think we are equally as discouraged in terms of the data because we're trying to, I think, determine is inpatient more effective than outpatient? Does length of stay in treatment make a difference? Is one approach different than another? Most of our treatment programs have some variability, although most of them follow the 12-step program. We will ask the researchers, because I think they're the most knowledgeable, to give us some recommendations. I mean, maybe it shouldn't be a 12-month follow-up if we're losing that many people at 12 months. Maybe we can do some more reasonable follow-up to get at some of this data. The numbers are as discouraging for us as they are for you, the number of people, because it's very hard to make major policy decisions on these tiny numbers of people.
Okay. Thank you. Did you have some other folks you wanted to call up?
Yes, I'd like to call John Zakel to the table then to talk about the CTSS rate increases. And I believe there was a question about the chemical dependency piece.
Yeah. Good morning, Madam Chair. John Zakel from DHS Chemical and Mental Health Services. I'm following up on a question that was brought up by Senator Lurie regarding the CTSS, that stands for Children's Therapeutic Services and Supports. Part of the Mental Health Initiative legislation that passed last year included a rate increase of 23% effective January 08. For certain services and certain providers. There was not enough money to do that kind of an increase across the board, so it was targeted only to certain services and certain providers. The list of services that were covered included about three services that are technically CTSS services, and then it included a number of other services that are technically not CTSS services. Most of those other services are usually not provided by CTSS providers, but one that is fairly common is diagnostic assessments. And I think that's the main one that you were concerned about. Our reading of that legislation was that the rate increase would only be given to CTSS providers when they provided CTSS services, which meant they did not get the increase for diagnostic assessments. We've taken another look at the legislation, and Senator Lurie, we agree with you that plain reading of the statute requires us to give the CTSS providers this rate increase for the other services in the list, which would include the diagnostic assessment. So we're taking the necessary steps to make that happen.
Thank you. Very good. I appreciate your looking into that for us.
Thank you.
Okay.
Madam Chair, when will this be effective? Will it be effective back to the January 1st date it was supposed to?
Madam Chair, Senator Lurie, yes, it'll be retroactive. Some of the providers might need to refile their claims, but we'll issue instructions about how to do that.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Okay. You wanted to answer Senator Rosen's questions?
Yes.
Unfortunately, she and I were tied up yesterday when the budget presentation was done, and she was asking about the three change items regarding chemical dependency. And methamphetamine.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, did you have a specific question there?
Madam Chair, thank
you. Senator Rosen.
Basically what's left for chemical health and or for the chemical dependency issues, because it looks like a lot of the funding has been cut. So if you can just explain that the...
There was money being taken out of the reserve fund.
Yes, Madam Chair. One of the proposals related to the Chemical Dependency Consolidated Fund balance. The Chemical Dependency Fund consolidates a number of revenue sources, and the total annual payments are about $130 million a year. And the way that works is that as revenues come in from various sources, including medical assistance, insurance, county share, and so forth, that's deposited into a dedicated account. Now, it's very hard to predict exactly how that's going to turn out each year. Some years it's a little low, some years it's high. This particular year, we're projecting a balance of $4.9 million at the end of the year in that account. So that represents about 4% of the year's expenditures. We are proposing that of that $4.9 million balance, that about half of that, the $2.5 million, be returned to the general fund. That would still leave some cushion for variations that might go the other way. But it's not a cut in treatment. The current services and current providers will still be covered.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
The restructuring of the methamphetamine funding?
Yes. Based on legislation that was passed a couple years ago, there's $300,000 a year dedicated for a methamphetamine information resource center in Wilmer. That pays for two FTEs. One of those FTEs has been vacant, the director position. What we're proposing is to have those functions be done in the DHS Chemical Health Office. Take the money that's been used for those FTEs and use it for meth treatment grants.
One more question, Madam Chair. The freezing of the CD treatment rates, if you could explain that, please.
Okay. Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, the page that relates to freezing chemical dependency treatment rates puts those providers on the same basis as all of the other providers that were covered by the COLA legislation. Rate increases are delayed from July 108 until July 109.
The way that was explained to me, Senator Rosen, because I don't think Mr. Zizekel made it as clear as he could, the counties can negotiate rates with CD providers. And so if they negotiate a rate that's higher than whatever the COLA was that we gave, then that provider would get that in addition to the COLA.
Okay.
And the county is not responsible for paying for it. We are. So that might explain at least a little bit of why we keep having these cost increases in the chemical dependency area that are not forecasted.
I see. Thank you.
Senator Lynch?
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, when we discussed that item yesterday, it seemed to me that one of the questions, though, was generated was, do those same individuals, they're impacted by that freeze, and they're also impacted by the change in the COLA. And so I just wanted to be clear that they're seeing
this. But
my
understanding is that they are separate proposals. They don't go together. Yeah.
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, the situation there, as Senator Berglund said, is that under the Chemical Dependency Fund, counties are able to negotiate rate increases that are higher than the COLA. The COLA required counties to do at least a 2% increase July 1/08. And so the CD providers are included on that COLA page to take out the 2%, but then there's a separate page to take out the additional amount over the 2% that is currently expected that counties would be negotiating if we didn't have this cap.
Okay, I think that answers those questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
There were some questions about the MFIP program.
I'm Ann Sessoms from the Department of Human Services. And the question I understood is about the change in the implementation date of the work participation bonus. Is that true? Okay. The department is unable to implement the system changes on the date that was established in legislation last year. And the forecast document showed that we moved it out to a date that the system, the computer system changes could be made. The governor also has a proposal that would change it from cash to food and aligns the date with those proposed system changes. And I think there are probably two things that contributed to the inability to meet the date. And one of them is the volume of changes that were passed in session last year with, and each proposal will have an individual estimated date and time, and but once we look at all of those changes that need to be made on the one computer system, the all of the changes could not be done on time. The department chose to assure that we met all the timelines for those that were had due dates prior to session. So if there was an implementation date that was earlier than the legislative session, we made those changes, and many of those changes were beneficial to families receiving MFIP. There, right now, Maxis, the computer system, also has the healthcare programs on it, too. So there were some changes to healthcare. There were some changes to MFIP. And there were some changes to child care that were all done and implemented, and we were unable to meet the date on the bonus.
And the proposal that the governor has in his budget to convert the bonus to a food benefit will delay it even longer, and I don't understand that. I mean, have you even started putting this change into the computer?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the policy staff are doing the analysis to that would require us to implement the bonus as food for people who are still in the food portion, or as cash for people who are still in the food portion or have gone off of MFIP. The programming for that would start May 1st, so they will start programming that. And if the change is made in statute, we will have to do some different analysis in order to program it to make it be for food for people who have left MFIP. And that's part of the reason for the extended date. I think, in addition, because of the challenges that we've had in meeting it, we wanted to assure when we chose the date that we could have it done by that date. We're implementing a statewide automated eligibility system for childcare right now, and we are scheduled to go into production March 31st, and that's where our resources have been devoted at this point, trying to assure that we bring up a functioning system for statewide childcare.
And was that a directive of the legislature also?
There was not a bill directing the department to do it. This was work that was started when childcare was still over at Children, Families, and Learning. And it came over with a partial system, and a decision was made that there were enough problems with the system that we couldn't go statewide with that system. And so programming was done to automate it. It will allow us to do federal reporting the way that we're required to do and things. And it will standardize. It will fix a lot of the issues that have been coming up about child care.
And were there any other alternatives discussed in the department besides making food bonus, in order to make it easier to administer?
Madam Chair, the alternatives, you mean instead of cash or food, was there something else considered besides cash or food?
Mm-hmm.
No, I don't think so. I mean, I don't know how we would issue a bonus that would the point of the bonus is to improve our work participation rate. And so I think we thought we had to do it in food or cash. I'm not aware of another way that we would do that.
And was there any consideration given to providing the bonus for people that are not receiving a food benefit, so that at least those people could get started with the bonus?
Oh, Madam Chair, is the question about trying to phase it in sooner?
Right.
What I understand is that in some ways it's adding a new program because it's different it's different than the programs that we have now. While it's tied to MFIP eligibility and losing MFIP eligibility, one or the other, the way computer programmers look at it, it is, and the way the system is designed, it's a separate issuance and there's separate logic. And so there isn't a way to do, what I understand is there isn't a way to do sort of partial. We implement either as cash or as food. We choose which population it goes to, and we have an implementation date.
Are there other questions on this issue? I guess the question is that you keep telling us that this is not a resource issue, that the delay is not a resource issue. I guess the question we have is, if we appropriated more money for you to implement this, would you be able to implement it sooner?
I'm not sure I can answer. Sometimes having more money for the computer system does mean we can do more. Sometimes it's a matter of having staff it can't be a short period because they have to understand the logic of the programming in order to do it correctly, which would mean over a long term having more staff rather than having, you know, funding for a couple FTEs for a certain period of time. And in addition, sometimes on the computer system, it's a contention for modules. So there will only be certain modules that have to do with issuance, but you can't have programming you can't have all sorts of programmers in that module at the same time actually trying to affect different changes. It has to be a little bit sequential. So I guess that's not a very satisfying answer, but I think part of it has to do with how many people you can actually have working on a module, and some of it has to do with the ability to ramp up and do something when you aren't adding to the complement for the long term, and the learning curve that people have to have in order to understand how to deal with these very complicated programs and to get eligibility right so that we don't make mistakes.
So if there were more resources available to you in order to do the food stamp proposal, could it be implemented sooner than the delay on top of the great delay we already are going to have?
Madam Chair, I don't know the answer to that question, and I would have to go back and ask.
All right. We'll wait for that answer to come.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Ms. Sessoms. I'm just sharing some of my frustration here. We repeatedly, in the past many months, talk about administrative cost, and you've indicated a number of times this morning we've heard about it's not possible because we ran into a roadblock because. And it seems to me that there's a well-established pattern here. And one of the things that we might want to take a look at is the long run and the long term. And, you know, I suppose one could argue maybe we have tried to do that with Health Match. It's been 7 years. But sooner or later, I would like to see the department and the governor's recommendation come forward with a truly systemic strategic plan, because it is very frustrating when legislation is passed and enacted to do good things, to contain cost, to increase eligibility, and then 12 months later and 18 months later and sometimes 7 years later, we come back and there's yet another stumbling block.
Well, I'm pretty frustrated about this. I originally suggested to the department that we hire a contractor to do this piece, and I was told that it wasn't possible, that they are the only ones that can do it. You're not the only frustrated one at the table, Senator Lynch. Are there any other questions on this issue? Okay, then I guess, Senator Prettner-Sullen, we had one more question for the department.
Okay, I was just wondering if anybody, Madam Chair, is here to address issues about nursing homes.
Well, that's in the testimony section of the bill.
Okay.
I think we had one more question about requirement in last year's legislation that the department develop a separate program for young adults within their state sex offender program.
Madam Chair, my name is Mike Tessner. I'm the Chief Executive for State Operated Services, Department of Human Services. The process that we went through to establish the program, we had identified, as I'm sure you'll recall, Madam Chair, that there's a group of young individuals, young adults, with very serious gaps in their maturity, their social skill set, that were being civilly committed to us for treatment. Mixing them in with older adults was presenting all sorts of management problems, as well as them not progressing in treatment. This committee put forward a proposal which was adopted, directing us to establish this program by January 1st of this year. We began that process by recruiting a clinical leadership for the program that was begun actually about this time last year. We successfully found a candidate to take that responsibility on, and that person came on board in May, late May of last year. They went through a program development process, which included looking at the population in question and where the real treatment issues were and what was the best approach to addressing those treatment issues. In that process, it was determined that there were actually two distinct groups of people. One group, very vulnerable, and really needed to be separate from the other group being far more predatory. So the decision was made to have two distinct programs physically separated so that we didn't have the problem of vulnerable people being subjected to more predatory folks. Once again, all in this young adult category. The decision was to take on the more vulnerable group first. We located that program in the Minnesota Security Hospital, primarily because of the vulnerability issues and the complex other disabling conditions that some of these young people have. That program, the design of the program, the training of the staff, the separation was achieved, and that program was fully operational in September of this past year. The same track, but stage second was the development of the program for the more predatory group. That program is located at the Moose Lake campus within the MSOP. It's a 25-bed program. The clinical leadership was identified in the fall. The treatment model, as I said, had already been designed. The initial training of the staff has begun. The problem we ran into was simply substantial physical space. It wasn't possible to simply vacate a unit and move everyone on because of other pressures to move people within the MSOP program, primarily transferring people from the St. Peter campus up to the Moose Lake Annex and closing units down at St. Peter for the sex offender program. So the decision was made to stage that. The unit that was selected has eight individuals on it already, so there actually are a core of eight young people. The transfer of the, if you will, the older adults off and the young people on is in process. That'll be completed, I believe, sometime in the next, between now and the end of April, and that program will be fully operational in May of this year.
Mr. Chesmer, last year when we discussed this, you told us you did not see any problem in achieving this by January of this year. And so I'm just wondering how much confidence we can have in your statement that this will be finished by May of this year.
Madam Chair, I was optimistic this time last year, and perhaps overly so. As we got into this population and better understood what its needs were, we had to make some decisions about how to locate two distinct programs rather than one. That was a complicating factor. The other thing that, frankly, I wasn't anticipating last year was the pressure and the staging of the movement from the St. Peter MSOP up to the annex and the kind of pressure that puts on the program in order to do it in a safe and responsible way. Those are the two factors that I was not giving fair weight, which caused me to be too optimistic.
Mr. Chesmer, why did it require us to put this legislation in place in order for you to understand the differences between the young people that you have in your program? I mean, I thought you were doing individual care plans for your residents in general anyway. So it's like all of a sudden you discover you've got a large number of them that have these social deficits and the are more vulnerable.
Madam Chair, if you'll recall, we had recognized this distinct need when you were contemplating this legislation. We had already initiated the plan to hire a clinical director whose job it would be to develop this service, so it wasn't as if we waited to be told. Why didn't we understand this earlier? We didn't. It came to our attention as we started, frankly, being more attentive to why people weren't progressing in treatment, why there were certain individuals that were creating behavior problems that didn't seem to get resolved, and where those were coming from. And, of course, that led us back to some young people with very serious social skill deficits, not knowing how to behave like an adult, not having ever had a chance as a young person to develop those type of behaviors. So it was an evolving understanding on our part of the nature of the population we were serving that coincided with your directive to develop this program.
Well, we're certainly glad you made the discovery. Are there any other questions? Thank you. Members, we're going to move on then to the testimony on the governor's budget. And we're going to start with Joe Keem, to be followed by Jessica Webster.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm Joe Keim. I am Executive Vice President of Geritown Medical. We are one of the largest long-term care pharmacies in the state of Minnesota. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify today on the proposed budget cut from AWP minus 12% to AWP minus 14%. When the governor took office during his first term, the rate was AWP minus 9%. Plus a dispensing fee of $365 with no copays for individuals. For a five-month period after he took office, that rate to balance the budget went to AWP minus 14 plus $365. It was then increased part of the way back to where it was. Since then, there have been several bills to lower this rate of reimbursement. Copays were instituted for patients. Now the current rate is AWP minus 12% plus $3.65. And we can't forget about the Minnesota wholesale drug distributor tax of 2%. Also, the formula doesn't take into account the copays that Medicaid recipients do not pay. Long-term care pharmacy services mentally retarded and developmentally disabled people as well as seniors. Those seniors who are in nursing facilities do not pay copays, but the mentally retarded and developmentally disabled that are housed in group homes and intermediate care facilities are lumped in with the retail Medicaid population, and they are required to pay copays. Most of these copays are uncollectible because these people are on a very slim stipend. They require more care and, in many cases, more one-on-one care than those seniors in skilled nursing facilities. The cuts the governor now proposes... In the past, he's proposed these about twice, and they've been rejected due to the negative impact on the Medicaid patients and participating pharmacies. This impact would be greater on long-term care pharmacy, and especially those rural pharmacies in outstate Minnesota that do service nursing homes, more Medicaid patients. I believe the number is about 55% more patients that the rural pharmacies service than the urban pharmacies. I'd like to speak to the negative impact specifically on our company, Geritown Medical. In 2007, our profit margin was 1.58% before federal and state taxes. The number in the state of Minnesota for retail pharmacies is generally 1.8% to 2.2%. The reason that our rate is less is because long-term care pharmacies do several things to help these patients. We do specialty packaging, and we do delivery. This doesn't happen in the retail setting. The delivery costs are soaring because of the gasoline prices. I believe our price per prescription on delivery right now is $3.17. The packaging is a much-needed safety device, especially for people in group homes and intermediate care facilities, because the people administering those medications are generally untrained medical personnel. They need the right doses. They need them at the right time. A lot of these people are non-English speaking, so So they really need the long-term care pharmacy and these services that we provide. In a study done by the Department of Human Services in Minnesota in February 2007, the cost of dispensing was $9.59 per Medicaid prescription. This is not inclusive of the 2% wholesaler drug tax. The cost of dispensing is significantly higher in long-term care. In 2005, I did a study for Geritam Medical. Our cost at that point in time was $13.52 per prescription. Since 2005, of course, the fuels have soared, the costs have soared. For about every dollar increase a gallon in gasoline, our delivery costs increase 17 cents per prescription. In 2007, Geritam received just under $7.3 million in revenue from state Medicaid. As I stated before, our profit before taxes was 1.58%. The 2% reduction would reduce our revenues by just under $146,000 annually. Our profit margin then before taxes would be 1.08%, which puts us significantly below the retail range of 1.8% to 2.2%, which is quite low to begin with. What I'd like to ask this committee is that you reject the governor's proposal. I'd also like to ask you in the future to look at the aggressive MAC pricing that the state has, and I'd like to also talk to you about reducing or eliminating copays for those mentally retarded and developmentally disabled people housed in group homes and intermediate care facilities. These are the most unfortunate of people, by no fault of their own, by no habits, by no bad behavior patterns or anything else. They're a very unfortunate group, and my heart goes out to them. I'd like to go further and ask you to look at a two-tiered system for long-term care pharmacy, those servicing institutionalized patients, as well as those servicing non-institutionalized patients. In Oregon and Delaware, they have a two-tiered system like that. Since the advent of Medicare Part D in 2006, all of the contracts for long-term care pharmacy and for retail pharmacy are different. The long-term care pharmacy contracts generally pay a minimum of 5% more, and it goes upward from there. These are the things we need to provide the packaging, to provide the delivery, to keep the patients safe. That's the main thing. Get them the right dose at the right time without getting it mixed up and avoiding the hospital stays that the state is going to have to pay for. I'm trying to make this as brief as possible. I know you're under the gun here for time, so if you'd like to ask any questions, I'd be happy to answer anything.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Keim, could you elaborate a little bit more on the aggressive MAC pricing and how that affects you?
Well, the state of Minnesota MACs the generic pricing. You're a state maximum allowable cost. It's calculated by the pill. The state of Minnesota is quite aggressive in comparison to other states on these generics. And with an already low reimbursement rate, if these pills get so close, on these MAC drugs, we're losing money already. And, you know, you're going to receive testimony from Michelle Itai from Walgreens Drug. She's going to talk much about the retail drug situation and how this will affect it. But this cut will put Medicaid prescriptions in the red throughout the state of Minnesota. As a long-term care pharmacy, since we receive the same reimbursement and our costs are higher, we are already in the red dispensing state Medicaid. Fortunately, at this point in time, only about 26% of our business is state Medicaid patients, but those patients are in the same homes we service with the Medicare Part D with the dually eligible patients. So our contracts with those PDPs are more generous than state Medicaid. So this allows us to keep functioning, but a 2% hit on state Medicaid would affect us very adversely. And the MAC drug pricing just adds to that.
So, Madam Chair, Mr. Keim, what you're saying is that the pricing, the state's pricing on the generic drugs is so aggressive that there's a profit margin between what you can buy it for at the wholesale rate?
That's considerably less than the AWP minus 14%. Those items are on generics that have been established and have been around for a while, and the formula there is MAC minus 12% plus 365, and it's proposed to go to minus 14%. The MAC established, I don't know what the formula is, but I print it up on the state and I look at it drug by drug, and those generics are very, very low. And on those drugs, no one's making money on it.
Thank you. Mr. Keim, these generic pricing policies, I believe, have been developed and handed down to the states by the federal government.
The MAC pricing varies from state to state, I believe. From what I understand, the MAC pricing varies from state to state. It's more aggressive. It's much more aggressive than the PDPs and the PBMs and those contracts with people who are dually eligible.
Well, all I know is that we have not, to my knowledge, changed the law in this area. So, you know,
Madam Chair.
Maybe we can ask the department to give us some information about that, and they can just provide it in writing and we'll distribute it.
Madam Chair, I was just wondering if it related to the multi-state compact that we belong to and the negotiating that occurs.
No, I don't believe so, because there are times when we negotiate, the best price we negotiate is for a non-generic drug. I mean, I've actually had constituents of mine write to me and say, how come you're wasting your money giving me this drug? And it's because it has been negotiated at a better price than the generic. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Jessica Webster, to be followed by Maureen O'Connell.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Jessica Webster. I'm with the Legal Services Advocacy Project. I'm also here with my director, Maureen O'Connell. Legal Services Advocacy Project is a part of Legal Aid, and Legal Aid provides free legal assistance to thousands of Minnesotans statewide. I have a few concerns I'd like to outline about MFIP and TANF, and Maureen will talk more about health care. Two concerns specifically. One is that the governor has proposed to take the entire TANF reserve of $91 million. To help balance the budget. This is much like the discussion yesterday about the Health Care Access Fund. This is federal money given to the states to help needy families. Some people talk about the TANF reserve as a surplus. Our view is when there are thousands of kids living in poverty, thousands of their parents living in poverty, there is no surplus, really. We have a weakening economy. We have rising unemployment. And at this time, we just don't think it makes sense to absolutely eviscerate this fund. Just a few moments ago, you heard the department, Ms. Ann Sessoms, talk about possibly, you know, being understaffed and under-resourced to put things into place. The advocacy community is not opposed to using some of these one-time dollars, perhaps $1 million out of the $91 million of the TANF reserve, to help DHS implement policies for low-income families that have already been passed by the legislature. Our second concern is related to page 10 of 43 in the governor's budget that you received. It's related to the MFIP work bonus and the food support simplification. As most of you know, this was legislation that was passed last year. It's a $75 bonus to families exiting MFIP if they're working certain hours and meeting a work participation rate. It helps the state meet the work participation rate. The department has proposed converting this to a food stamp bonus, and that may not sound like a significant change because a lot of these families are still living in poverty. They still need food, but the hard reality is that our families are able and more better resourced to meet their food needs. $75 is very significant. $75 may as well be $750 for some of these families in a number of circumstances. Just a few examples. If you miss a shift of work, that could be $75. That helps you meet the rent at the end of the month. $75 could help you pay utility. $75 could help pay a car repair that might help you not lose your job. So $75 cash really provides these families a flexibility that a food stamp bonus does not provide. We know our food shelves are absolutely bursting at the seams with need, and we're not saying that food shelves can meet these needs, but families finding $75 out in the community to help with these other needs is very difficult. So we would oppose converting the $75 cash bonus to a food support bonus. We're also concerned about the delays, but I think you heard about that this morning, so I won't go further on that. Thank you.
Are there questions? If not, Maureen.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Maureen O'Connell, and I'm the Advocacy Director for the Legal Services Advocacy Project. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on the Governor's 2008 supplemental budget. Like many of you on this committee, after participating in the interim health care reform process as a member of the working group on restructuring the health care system through identified savings, we at Legal Aid are having a difficult time reconciling the supplemental budget with the goals of establishing universal coverage and the other health care reform proposals brought forth by the Governor's Transformation Task Force and the Health Care Access Commission. The supplemental budget actually illustrates why Legal Aid has long supported health care reform. As a result of three budget proposals, the repeal of additional MA and automatic Minnesota Care coverage, eliminating the outreach program, and repealing the expansion to 215% for Minnesota Care, close to 31,000 low-income children, families, and households without children will not have access to health care coverage. Transferring funds from the Health Care Access Fund to fund general fund obligations represents another missed opportunity to expand coverage and achieve the goals of health care reform. Yet we know that these 31,000 Minnesotans will get sick and need health care services. We know these Minnesotans will be uninsured. We know that children will go without preventive services, care will be delayed, families will end up in emergency rooms, parents will be unable to work due to untreated medical conditions. Medical debt will continue to soar. And finally, we know that overall health care costs will continue to spiral out of control, and in the end, we will all pay for their care through increased premiums and uncompensated care. Without comprehensive health care reform, health care services for low-income working families, the disabled, and elderly will continue to be the target of budget cuts when times are lean. Many Minnesotans will continue to face an uncertain health care future. They will struggle to afford coverage and navigate an increasingly complex health care delivery system. On the complexities of the health care delivery system, I would like to make two points. One is Senator Berglund has already noted this morning. We continue at Legal Aid to and we will be very interested in seeing the letter that the department is going to produce on the repeal of the additional MA and Minnesota Care coverage for children. We continue to be puzzled, as Senator Berglund stated, about why it takes 2 months when we know these children are eligible and when we already have in law that the counties should be facilitating the application process for Minnesota Care as children transfer from MA to Minnesota Care. So we just, in talking to an attorney last night, we continue to just be puzzled, as Senator Berglund already noted this morning. Also, in light of the department's decision to delay or do away with Health Match, we again think that the outreach incentive program is very important. Currently, St. Cloud Legal Aid and Western Minnesota Legal Services are the only organizations under contract to participate in the incentive program that was passed last year. And it's ironic that yesterday they went to a training session under this incentive program on how to, so they were trained yesterday by the department. There were legal aid professionals, there were county people and people from healthcare systems that spent a day being trained on how to fill out the application and how it should be submitted. It was a 9-to-4 day going over the healthcare programs. They spent 4 hours directly on the application process and all the verifications that need to be submitted. And again, this is people that are already familiar with the healthcare system and benefit programs, need a day of training in order to learn how to help people fill out the application. The manual that we received at the end of the day is 53 pages long. The system is way too complex for your average layperson. And it's the reason why we have people in Minnesota Care that should be an MA. It's why we have so many uninsured that could be on the healthcare programs. We think it is really imperative that you continue to fund the outreach program that you passed last year. A final story to just demonstrate how this plays out. We recently represented a family that received an overpayment notice of approximately $4,500 from their county for medical assistance services that they received. This family sold their house, moved into an apartment, still had the proceeds from the sale of their house in their bank account. They applied for medical assistance for their children. They knew that they had the assets, so they knew as parents that they wouldn't be eligible. So they did. They didn't disclose. Four children, if you're applying only for your children, which they were very clear about in the application, you don't have to disclose your assets. There's no asset requirement for children. So they told the worker that they were only applying for their children. Their worker came back and said to them, You can also be eligible. And they said, no, we can't be eligible because we have these assets. We have this asset from our house that we're going to be reinvesting. And she checked with her supervisor and came back and told them, no, you can also be eligible. And so they said, well, okay, you must know the rules. I guess we were wrong. And so they went on medical assistance, and 6 months later, received a notice that they were under a fraud investigation for not disclosing the assets and that they had received an overpayment of $4,500. Legal aid helped them, and they were not charged with fraud, but they still have the overpayment, which legal aid has helped to reduce because for some period of time, she was pregnant while they were on medical assistance, and you don't have an asset test when you're pregnant. So that reduced their overpayment. But again, I think that story shows the committee the complexity of the programs and how people, not only clients, but also workers, are confused because of the many rules.
Thank you. Are there questions? Okay. All right, then we'll take John Lips, followed by Carrie Thurlow.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. My name is John Lips. I'm the Vice President of Advocacy for Care Providers of Minnesota. And with me is Carrie Thurlow, who is the Vice President of Advocacy for the Minnesota Health and Housing Alliance. Our two organizations collaborate on public policy issues under the name the Long-Term Care Imperative, and the members of our associations are nursing facilities, as well as elderly waiver providers, home care agencies, and the like. So we provide services to older adults across the state of Minnesota. We are handing out, with apologies for not having these submitted yesterday, we're handing out a few slides that Ms. Thurlow will describe in just a couple of minutes. I'll make some introductory remarks. Before I proceed as well, if it's not inappropriate, I want to acknowledge we have 10 or 20 real-life long-term care providers with us in the room today. They're sitting off to our right, which I don't know, and some to the left as well. So raise your hand or stand or do whatever you'd like. So we appreciate that they could be here as well. And we'll be urging our members to speak with their individual legislators person to person as there's time for that over the next few weeks. So we'll commend you to those conversations. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on the governor's supplemental budget recommendations. We are sensitive to the difficult job that lies ahead of you. And we will sort of after today begin thinking as well as we can as well about what solutions, ideas, creative things we might be able to come up with that would be helpful. So we will put our minds to that work as well. If there's one message we want to leave you with today, it's that the governor's proposal does represent funding reductions, funding cuts for our members. There has been some confusion. We've perceived some confusion in the media, as well as some confusion that we observed in some discussions in the House yesterday about what the budget proposals are. So with apologies if we've already covered this, we just wanted to start by mentioning how we're interpreting the budget recommendations. First of all, the governor's proposal is to repeal rebasing for nursing facilities altogether. So all of the funding and all of the language as we interpret the proposal is to be repealed. From a funding standpoint, just from a pure dollars and cents standpoint, we believe that amounts to about $100 million state share that was in the budget over the eight-year phase-in. And because in the world of nursing facility rates, whatever the state share is, there's a multiplier that goes along with it. Private pay rates increase as well when medical assistance rates increase, and then there's a federal match as well. So if there's a reduction in the state share spending, we kind of, in our minds as a rule of thumb, sort of triple what the impact of that means in terms of potential revenue loss for our members. So if there was $100 million in the state share in the budget over the eight-year phase-in, it's much more than that overall. So there's a total repeal of rate of rebasing. That's the funding piece from a caregiving perspective. It certainly inhibits our ability. We can talk more about this as well, but to close that gap between rates and costs, which would enable us to stabilize the nursing facilities and get to the staffing and the quality of care that we want to. And then finally, from a policy perspective, it sort of, we feel like it brings us back to square one. It just takes us back to COLAs. And we don't exactly know where we go from there. If we're just going to go back to COLA after COLA, a rate on rate system, it doesn't lead to financial stability for our members. So from a policy perspective, it is frustrating for us as well. While the governor's proposal then is to repeal rebasing, including the dollars that were in the budget for 2008, and then in turn the governor adds back some dollars in 2009 to provide a COLA, but there was some confusion, again, in other rooms of the Capitol that we just want to be clear. There's a separate line in the governor's budget that talks about COLAs, how COLAs for 2008 will be shifted to 2009 for all providers, excluding nursing facilities. But the governor, I think, properly in that description, separated how nursing facilities are treated from how the other long-term care providers are treated. So we just want to make sure you don't interpret that secondary line, which has a reference to excluding nursing facilities. Don't misinterpret that to mean that for 2008 there is new money in the budget for nursing facilities. So that probably didn't help. That probably just made it more confusing. But we wanted to just take a second and touch on that as well. So the bottom line for nursing facilities is that there are no funding increases for fiscal year 2009 for rate year 2008. And the proposal then also is to eliminate the COLA for 2008 for all of the other long-term care providers who participate in the COLA, the elderly waiver providers and the other Medicaid waiver providers, group residential housing, chemical dependency, all of those groups that normally are recipients of the COLA, all of that is removed and also moved to 2009. And if we're reading the governor's budget page correctly, when you add these things together, it's a total of about $31 million removed from the budget for 2008. So these constitute real cuts for our people. A rate freeze for 2008 amounts to a real cut. It amounts to a real budget cut for our members, and we just want to make sure that we leave you with that impression. So with that, I'll ask Ms. Thurlow if you want to make some additional comments that relate to the slides that we've passed out.
Okay. Mr. Lips, before you go on, you mentioned a number of figures, and your last one was $31 million affecting nursing homes. Earlier in your testimony, you talked about the $100 million in rebasing.
Madam Chair, and
Mr.
members.
Mr. Lips.
Yes, Madam Chair and members, forgive me. The $31 million figure that I mentioned, I arrived at by, and the budget page that I was looking at was the summary budget page. It sort of looks, it has this format, and it was marked page 13 of 43. And just adding up the proposed reduction for fiscal year 2009, just for fiscal year 2009 for nursing facilities, a little over $5 million. And for all of the other long-term care providers who would have received a COLA in 2008, a number of about $26 million. So what I meant to say was adding those two numbers together, just for fiscal year 2009 or for our rate year 2008, there's about a $31 million difference there over how we left session at the end of the 2007 session. The $100 million figure that I mentioned was an estimate of the total number of dollars that were in the budget, not only for the current biennium and for the tails, but also for the 4 years that followed that. So there was a proposed eight-year implementation of rebasing. And so the total state share dollars that were in the budget for that, for the total eight-year period, was about $100 million.
Mr. Lips, thank you for the clarification. I know that that this is an issue that many members are concerned with. So I think it's important that we are quite clear in what those figures are and what's behind those figures.
Yes. I'm sorry I didn't do a better job the first time.
And I realize the gavel's left me, but Ms. Thurlow, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairs and members of the committee. I'll be working off this particular packet of slides also. And as it should probably come as no surprise to any of you, we're very concerned about the governor's proposal with regard to the cuts for long-term care. And we'd like to share with you some data indicating some of the reasons why we think you should oppose the governor's proposal. First, I want to start out by saying that this really is a jobs issue for us. And I think that it's important that as we talk about the factors driving the downturn in the economy, we need to look at the impact on cuts in long-term care and the impact that they will have on jobs and local economies in Minnesota. If the governor's budget is approved, nursing facilities will have received no rate increases for three of the last 6 years. This freeze in rates means that nursing facilities have no reliable funding source to pay for wage increases for staff, recruit new talent, or to provide other benefits for their employees. The first slide before you is data that actually came from the Department of Human Services Transform 2010 Economic Impact Study. It looked at the number of jobs that residential care facilities create in Minnesota. And so this includes nursing facilities, but also other long-term care residential facilities that may not be nursing facilities. And you can see that it shows that long-term care residential facilities support nearly 120,000 jobs in Minnesota. That's both those that we directly employ and those that we have a ripple effect on by contracting with others and supporting other businesses in the state. If you turn to the next slide, then this map we estimate looking at sort of the financial stability of nursing facilities in the state and sort of taking this jobs data, the long-term care imperative estimates that over 20,000 of these jobs are currently at risk due to financial crisis faced by these facilities. Our concern is that if the governor's proposal is enacted, these jobs, that this impact will be even greater, and that more jobs in Minnesota's communities will be at further risk.
The next thing that I want to talk about also, though, is that these funding cuts are really not about facilities or nameless facilities, but they're really about how they will impact the caregivers that take care of our grandparents and parents in their most critical times of need. Funding cuts, you know, plain and simple, hurt caregivers. Most of our caregivers are not in this business because of money, yet they deserve to make a living wage as they care for our parents and grandparents. Every time a nursing facility funding is cut, the most significant impact falls on our caregivers. And I didn't make copies of this, but I want to share with you that this is a letter that one of the caregivers working in one of our member facilities wrote after the 2007 budget passed, where we had some increases, but perhaps not as much as the imperative would have liked. And she writes, "I started this job at $9.13 an hour 2 years and 4 months ago. I now make $9.36. You can do the math that it's less than a 50-cent raise over two years of service. I'm a mother of two growing boys, and this is potentially what I will make this year." And she calculates it out that her salary before taxes would be $19,468.80 before taxes. If she were to choose family medical insurance, it would be $6,000 for her for the year. She estimates that her budget for groceries is $300 a month. You go through her budget here and you'll realize that this is a woman that doesn't ask for a lot. She estimates $30 a week of gas. For heat, water, electricity, and sewer, it's an average of $300 a month or $3,600 a year. Lunch tickets for her kids, $20 a week or $740 a year. Car insurance, $1,080 for the year. House payment, insurance, taxes, $260 a month or $3,120 for the year. Phone, and she writes in parentheses here, "My in-laws live in Canada." Still, her budget is only $84 a month. So even with those long-distance charges. She writes miscellaneous expenses such as personal needs, shampoo, conditioner, those that we all need. Toilet paper, laundry soap, $75 a month. And then she asks, she has question marks because she doesn't know how she's going to pay for things like clothes, shoes, jackets, car repairs, house repairs, medical copays, office copays, prescriptions. If I choose health insurance, this is what my bills add up to, which is $21,608, but I only make $19,468 before taxes. Without health insurance, I need $15,608 before taxes for bills. She goes on to conclude that, you know, she simply can't afford to continue working in that facility. And that's just one example. When we talk about how these cuts that the governor is proposing will impact caregivers, we know that currently they don't make a lot of money, and we know that that will have a huge impact on folks like this particular caregiver. The next item that I'd like to cover, though, is that nursing facility rates fall far short of the cost of care. And this is an issue that we covered a lot last year, that rates are not keeping up with the rate of inflation. If you turn to your packet, this is the next slide. Again, this is probably not news to any of you. We've testified to this before. But a recent national study shows that current nursing home rates are about $25 per resident per day less than the actual cost of care. And the gap has been growing in the last 5 years, and that Minnesota currently ranks about fourth worst out of 38 states that participate in the study. Another year without a rate increase will make the gap between rates and costs worse and force providers to cut back on staffing or limit or eliminate wage increases. And I don't think that's an over-exaggeration of what providers are really looking at as we talk to our members. The next slide, again, is not new. You've seen this before, but again, it just shows the huge gap between the rate of inflation and the rates that we are currently asked to deal with here in Minnesota. I'd also like to make the point that long-term care funding is not driving this budget deficit. I know we've heard a lot of discussion that Health and Human Services is a target because it has a large projected growth and is a large part of the state government budget, and I would acknowledge that. But the next slide that you look at, the state funds are set aside for care centers are not being used. What this really demonstrates is there is a declining investment by the state in nursing facilities since 2004. If you compare, the gold bar is what you need to look at here.
In 2004, we budgeted almost $445 million to nursing homes. And in 2007, that figure that was allocated or budgeted was down to $409 million. So you can see that the actual spending in nursing facilities is actually reducing, and we'd like to make that point very clear. The fact that the next point I want to make, though, also is not only do funding cuts hurt caregivers, but they do impact quality care. And we've had a lot of discussion amongst our various trade associations about actually saying that out loud, but we just know it to be true that our parents and grandparents deserve the best possible care, period. And funding cuts will impact our members' ability to provide quality care. We know in talking to our members and in light of the budgets that they have to work with, we're concerned about the potential for mishaps to occur, and we're concerned about being able to meet the quality standards that we should all expect for parents and grandparents. Finally, I'd like to end by sharing with you some new data that you may or may not have heard. And the fact of the matter is that Minnesotans support increased funding for older adult services. In December of 2007, the Long-Term Care Imperative employed Anderson, Niebuhr & Associates, a polling firm, to conduct a poll of Minnesota voters. The poll was conducted in the month of January, and we received the final results in February. And respondents were asked to rate older adult services compared to a variety of other state priorities and to give their opinion on the need for increased funding for older adult services. The results confirmed Minnesotans support funding for older adult services, and I think that the findings are quite dramatic. Here are some of the results. 83% of Minnesota voters believe that additional resources are needed for long-term care. 6 in 10 of those voters said that funding for older adult services should be increased, even if new tax revenues are required. 85% of the respondents disagree that Minnesota should cut older adult funding to balance the budget. They believe it's the wrong direction to go. And when asked what should be the most important priority for the state legislature in terms of funding over the next 2 years, elderly services rank second, only to K-12 education. And I'd like to make a special note about that last question. That was actually the first question we asked respondents before they knew anything about the poll. So even before knowing that it was about older adult services, Minnesotans know that this is an important issue and that funding cuts are the wrong direction in preparing for a massive demographic change. With that, I'll just close by saying thank you for the opportunity to testify. We urge this committee to preserve funding for older adult services. We know that this is a difficult year in terms of solving the budget deficit, but we do strongly urge you to reject the governor's proposal for funding cuts to long-term care.
Thank you. I have a couple questions to ask you, and before I do that, I just want you to know that that this is a pretty hard job we have, and so part of the reason they pay me is to ask people hard questions. So the first question that I have is in regard to this gap that you've identified on one of your slides here. I guess it's the one with the gold bars on it. Mm-hmm. So if this is the gap in what it costs you to provide services, where do you get the difference?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's a great question. And we actually ask and survey our members how they deal with this shortfall. And I'll start by answering, and then if Mr. Lips has any additional information, he can answer. Our members, speaking only for my members at the MHHA, employ a number of different strategies. A number of members have fundraising efforts, which, again, help supplement and make up the gap, but are not reliable funding sources for wage increases or providing benefits or the like. They employ other strategies as well. Medicare maximization in some parts of the region are a way to close this gap. And there are other strategies as well, and I'm actually looking to John to see what other Reserves would be another major area where they would look, although many of our members are now reporting that they've depleted their reserves over the years.
Madam Chair, those are the top three that come to my mind as well: fundraising, dipping into reserves, and Medicare utilization. Medicare has become increasingly important over the last several years as the Medicaid gap widens, and it makes the discussions that happen at the federal level all that much more sort of important for our members as we watch the last couple of years. And indeed, as we speak today, there's discussion about whether the Medicare market basket should be increased as well. So Medicare has become very, very important.
So by presenting this chart to us, is it for us to believe that we should be through our rates paying for services provided under Medicare?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, no, that's not what we're indicating. But a vast majority of the clients that we serve or the residents that we serve in our buildings are on medical assistance for the majority of their stay. We certainly think that it's appropriate to maximize Medicare when appropriate and when those funds are available. But the fact of the matter is that the single largest payer for our residents is Medicaid. And when you have a gap that is simply this large, it is hard to remain financially viable.
So how much of this gap is Medicare?
Madam Chair, this slide is intended only to show the gap between Medicaid allowable costs as reported by providers in the states that participate in this study, which is an American Healthcare Association study, and the rates that the Medicaid programs in those states are paying. So it's merely intended to be an illustration of the gap between rates and costs for Medicaid clients.
Well, I would say it's just a little bit misleading then.
Okay.
The second question I have is in regard to the jobs at risk. Now, I'm a little bit confused as to whether these are jobs at risk regardless of what happens with the budget or if these are jobs at risk due to what might happen in the governor's budget.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I apologize if that wasn't entirely clear. This particular estimation by the Long-Term Care Imperative is based on the financial survey data that we reported in 2007. And so what we did is we estimated, based on sort of the number of jobs that our providers are responsible for, just looking at their current status, financial viability, and sort of where they stand currently before the governor, before, you know, sort of the scenario if you were to enact the governor's budget. This is currently how many jobs we estimate are at risk based on the data that we know. The point here is that we estimate that potentially more jobs will be at risk if the governor's proposal was to become law.
Now, I can understand part of that because when we give a COLA, part of it's earmarked for wages and part of it goes to the facility for increased costs of inflation. But I don't understand, I mean, what seemed to me, and I'm not suggesting this is a good idea, but just so we can understand jobs at risk here, it seems to me that if the amount of money that you're given to provide COLA changes, that you would just not provide a COLA of as large a size in the second year.
And, Madam Chair,
Rather than lay somebody off.
To clarify, Madam Chair, when we estimate jobs at risk, what we're really talking about are facilities at risk of closure. We came up with this estimation based on on the financial data of those facilities. It's the last slide in the last slide in your packet corresponds with this, that we estimate that about 30% of facilities statewide, based on the data that we reported last year, are at risk of closure because they have operating margins of negative 5% or worse and have no cash on hand. So the jobs at risk here correspond not to the wage increases that we could potentially give, but are really based on whether the facilities remain financially viable to even stay open. And so what we're really talking about potentially are facilities closing here.
Okay, but in terms of the governor's budget, which is what we're talking about today, you would be at risk for covering the cost of inflation for your food and heat and lights that you would not be receiving an increase for. But you're not liable for a cost of living increase in a year that you haven't given it yet.
Madam Chair, if I understand your question, I think I probably agree with your question, but the point here is that our members don't have anywhere else to turn. Even if there's a rate freeze this year, they won't have the money to even keep the lights on. And so I don't know if I'm answering your question or not.
No, but I think I've made my point. Then let's turn to the chart that talks about state funds not being used. And I'm wondering if you could describe to us the reason that the money isn't being used. I mean, is it because you don't have as many patients in your facilities as we were projecting at the time we did the budget? Or is it because you're not?
Madam Chair, yes, that is part of it. This gets into some details about the state budgeting forecast that I don't know if either Ms. Thurlow or I will be able to answer in detail, but that is part of the answer, that the legislature concludes its work during each budget-making year with estimates about how many people, Medicaid clients, will be served in long-term care facilities. And that is part of the answer, that it turns out over time that fewer people are served in those facilities than had been expected. And so census, as the administrators refer to it, is part of the issue. Why there are fewer people being served there is partly a function of there being more and more alternatives outside of nursing facilities. So that is a part of the issue here. The slide is intended to illustrate, as much as anything, that with respect to the nursing facility part of the budget, which is just one piece of the long-term care part of the budget, which is one piece of the whole HHS picture, but just for that piece, that the level of investment in that piece has been declining, and it's just a reaction to what sometimes, again, sort of in media reports and other places, we sometimes perceive that that part of the budget is viewed as a driver. Meanwhile, the state's overall investment in long-term care for people being served outside of nursing homes, people being served in all the Medicaid waivers and so on, that part of the budget is growing.
Thank you for that clarification. Any other questions? Senator Prettner-Sullen.
Madam Chair, actually, Ms. Thurlow explained some of what I was going to ask, but I would like to point out that in northeastern Minnesota, there are 50% of the facilities that are in danger of closure. And that is why I've been such a bulldog on the nursing home issues. This is a dire situation in northeastern Minnesota.
And Madam Chair and Senator Sullen, I do want to make a point of clarification that that map is based on the data we reported in 2007. We're working on updating this particular map as well, but I just want to make that clarification as well.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Erickson-Rolfes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not so much a question as a comment related to Senator Prettner-Sullen's comment. I want to thank you for the work you do for long-term care. Over the interim in my district, we had a nursing home closed in Preston, Minnesota. And that's a heartbreaker for small communities. It's the town's largest employer. I believe they had about 63 employers. They're the largest consumer of public utilities. There's lots and lots of families in a small town that are impacted, not only the workers, but the families of the residents. And everyone did a really great job down there trying to reassign residents to nursing homes as nearby as possible. But still, when you have folks that have grown up in a hometown area and now are residents in a nursing home 50 miles away, they're not going to be able to get the daily family visits that they had. So I will speak to the desperation of nursing homes out there, and I have several others in my district that are hanging on by their fingernails. So it's really dire.
Members, I'm not asking these questions because I think our nursing homes don't need the money. But I do think that when we get information presented to us, that we should have all of the information so that we're not misled. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate that. And I understand that. And just a couple comments myself, because I'm in one of those areas where there it's pretty dire also with the 14 nursing homes that I represent. But Ms. Thurlow, you mentioned that it's a jobs issue. And I agree to a certain extent, as Senator Erickson Rope said, that many of these facilities are the largest employers in these towns. However, it goes on beyond that. When you talk to the worker and the care provider in that facility, it's much more than that. And of course, it is all about money, but it's also about the regulations that we put on these nursing homes. And I have a particular facility in Winnebago called Parker Oaks, and Deb Barnes is the administrator there, and she has been in long-term care work for 30 years, and she's just an excellent administrator. Calls me up just in a panic this fall because requirements for the RNs to fill out the papers and do all the reporting has left a shortage for the real care on the floor. I mean, they've even been so creative in all these nursing homes to provide to hire people to babysit so they can just get enough RNs to maneuver around and do the shifts. It's very, very stressful. And when Deb Barnes is in almost in tears, I know this is a serious issue. So we have to look at the total picture of long-term care and what we're doing with our mandates, our regulations, our funding, and really, really give it some attention, because this issue is not going to go away with just a COLA increase or a rebasing issue fix. It's a bigger picture.
Senator Rosen, every once in a while we look into this, and we've had difficulty finding regulations that we could get rid of that aren't required by the federal government. So there's not a lot of flexibility we have, at least at the state level, regarding these things.
Well, Madam Chair, with respect to the RN issue, I did get Assistant Commissioner Scott Lights to work with Deb Barnes and a group of the administrators down there. And I stayed out of it because I think it's better sometimes when a legislator is out of this whole thing. And there is there are some things that can be done on a legislative level to ease some of those restrictions. Maybe temporarily. We'll have to do something long term, but I think we need to give it a little more attention.
Well, we're always interested to hear what they are.
Yep.
Every once in a while we spend a lot of time kind of gnashing through it, and we usually come up with practically nothing. So if there are ideas the department has, we'd love to hear about them. Other questions?
What? Madam Chair.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
One more comment, and that is that in rural Minnesota, it's not only a situation of care for our elderly, but it's also a case where it's an economic factor for the community oftentimes. And in terms of these nursing homes, if they close, that is sometimes one of the biggest industries that is in that small community. In addition, as Senator Erickson Ropes mentioned, if a facility closes, then oftentimes it's very hard for families and loved ones to visit their loved ones because they're at such a distance that they can't make regular trips. So it becomes a core or a heart to the community and adds to the economy in addition to and provides all these jobs in addition to the care that it provides for our elderly.
Any other comments? Thank you. Then we will take Julie Bruner to be followed by Deborah Schlick. Ms. Commit is filling in.
Madam Chair, yes, that's correct. I am not Julie Bruner. I'm Catherine Commit from the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. The council is the trade association for Minnesota's 8 nonprofit health plans. Thank you for the opportunity to share our comments and concerns about the governor's proposed supplemental budget recommendations. We appreciate the challenge of resolving the state's deficit, but we also believe that the cuts proposed fall disproportionately on health care and are in conflict with current efforts to reform the existing health care system. In fact, 56% of the cuts come out of the health care programs. The first issue I would like to highlight is the use of the Health Care Access Fund to balance the budget. This proposal takes $250 million out of the Health Care Access Fund and transfers it to the general fund. The Health Care Access Fund was created to fund Minnesota care and should not be used to backfill a deficit in the general fund. The expansion of the withhold on health plans will also have a significant impact. For example, for one plan, this would represent a nearly $20 million reduction. The expansion of the withhold is more than what the margins are for health plans. Over the past 10 years, the average margin for the health plans has been 0.83%. In addition, the withhold changes include shifting or delaying payments into the future bienniums, which brings into question the actuarial soundness of the rates. We are also very concerned with the repeal of the outreach grant program established last session. We know that 60% of the uninsured are eligible for existing health care programs. It is sometimes difficult for individuals and families to determine their eligibility or understand their health care options, and the enrollment process is daunting and confusing. The problems with the Health Match program makes this activity even more important. The outreach funding that you and your colleagues passed last session would have put information and help where it is needed most. These efforts are essential to ensure every Minnesotan has access to affordable health coverage now and into the future. We are disappointed that this proposal repeals a number of the eligibility expansions set to become effective over the next year. For example, the elimination of the transitional medical assistance for children will result in over 20,000 children without insurance. These children will be denied continuity of care simply because their family income is slightly over the federal poverty level. It is unlikely that these children will receive cost-effective and preventive services like immunizations and well-child visits that are so important to their health. We do appreciate that the governor's recommendations do not interrupt the services or eligibility for children and families currently enrolled in our state public programs, but we believe that more needs to be done. It is imperative that the momentum generated this fall and the previous summer around the health care reform, covering the uninsured, and making health care more affordable continue to move forward. Unfortunately, several of the governor's budget recommendations move us in the wrong direction. We hope that the legislature will seek alternative ways to resolve this budget deficit rather than looking to the Health Care Access Fund and state public health care programs for Minnesota's citizens. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kmit. And just a little correction. It's more than $250 million because
you,
of the refinancing proposals that are in the budget itself. It's really $398 million. And I think, you know, just as I wanted to make sure we understood the charts that were presented to us in the last meeting, I think we need to be clear about how much of the Health Care Access Fund is being used to balance the budget.
Madam Chair, thank you very much for that correction. We'll make sure we get that right.
Any other comments or questions? Okay. If Deborah doesn't mind, I have a couple people here who took off from work, and so I'd like to make sure we get them in. Michelle Atehi. I'm probably really butchering that name, but welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Michelle Ate. I'm a pharmacist, and I'm a member of the Minnesota Pharmacist Association. And today I'm here to speak on behalf of the Minnesota Community Pharmacist Business Coalition, which includes the Minnesota Pharmacist Association, the Minnesota Retailers Association, the Minnesota Grocers Association, and the National Association of Chain Drug Stores. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today on the governor's proposed budget cuts. because some of the information that I'm presenting contains a lot of important numbers, if you don't mind, I want to make sure I get it right, so I'll read through this, and then I'd be happy to answer any questions for you at the end. Contained in the governor's budget proposal is the recommendation that pharmacy reimbursement be reduced from the current rate of average wholesale price minus 12% to average wholesale price minus 14%. This proposed cut is one that the governor has repeatedly suggested and that the legislature has repeatedly rejected due to the negative impact that this would have both on our Medicaid patients and our Minnesota pharmacies. Minnesota currently has approximately 1,262 pharmacies and roughly 195,000 people on fee-for-service Medicaid. On average, Minnesota loses 12 to 13 pharmacies per year and has a shortage of approximately 400 pharmacists. Pharmacists in our rural areas serve many nursing homes, hospitals, and other entities by providing medication reviews and for ordering and delivering medications to your patients. Potential negative impact if this legislation is enacted. Average pharmacy profit margins are in the range of 1.8 to 2.2%. Further reduction in reimbursement will put pharmacists' profit margin below the cost of dispensing in many cases and force our pharmacies to no longer accept Medicaid patients. This would limit a patient's access to their medications and the drug therapy expertise that pharmacists provide. I've included in my handouts today a spreadsheet that illustrates the impacts of the proposed cuts. Pharmacies have little control over their cost. There's the cost of the drug product, and pharmacists have no control over the prices of the pharmaceuticals we purchase. The drug prices are set by the manufacturer, and then the wholesalers mark up the products and offer pharmacies a contracted rate plus the state-imposed tax on pharmaceuticals. The Minnesota Wholesale Drug Distributor Tax. There are some state policies that impact the cost of pharmaceuticals, especially the imposition of the Minnesota Wholesale Drug Distributor Tax. This tax is paid by the wholesale drug distributor and passed on to the pharmacy as a line item on our invoice for pharmaceutical purchases. No other state has this tax, and Minnesota Medicaid is the only payer, including Medicare, that does not reimburse pharmacies for this tax. Cost of dispensing. Cost of dispensing refers to the cost of providing the dispensing service. The service includes overhead, staff, and the professional services of the pharmacist related to the dispensing function. The Minnesota Department of Human Services conducted a survey of dispensing costs for pharmacies participating in Minnesota Medicaid programs. The results were released in February of 2007 and found that the statewide average or mean cost of dispensing weighted by the Medicaid volume was $9.59 per prescription, and this cost did not factor in the 2% Minnesota wholesale drug distributor tax that the state does not pay. Pharmacist Medicaid reimbursement is controlled by the state. Pharmacists do not mark up the cost of the goods to make a profit. Medicaid reimbursement for pharmaceuticals and dispensing services are set in Minnesota statute. Pharmacies are reimbursed the lower of the formula set in Minnesota statute, which is currently at average wholesale price minus 12% plus $3.65, or the maximum allowable cost, MAC, set by the state plus a dispensing fee of $3.65, or the pharmacy's usual and customary price. This formula does not reimburse pharmacies for the wholesale drug tax of 2% and does not take into account the uncollected copays that Medicaid recipients do not pay. Minnesota pharmacies help secure savings for our healthcare system. Over the course of the last several years, as proposals have been brought forward to cut pharmacy reimbursement, we've brought forward several cost savings alternatives, and most of these were welcomed and, in fact, implemented, producing significant savings to the state. Some significant achievements include implementing the preferred drug list, which saved the state $14 million per year, maintaining a generic substitution rate of 59.3% for our Medicaid program, and implementing medication therapy management services for Medicaid patients. With that being said, there's still more that could be done, and in my handouts today, I've included two pieces that contain further recommendations on additional measures that could be taken to increase efficiency. In the interest of time, I will highlight only one. In 2005, Minnesota began covering medication therapy management services for Medicaid patients. This service has demonstrated results in reducing health care costs for patients who are on multiple medications to treat chronic conditions. When this legislation was passed, there was an unintended barrier included that limited eligible patients from receiving the service in their homes. This means that in order for these patients to be served, DHS needs to pay not only for the service, but also for the transportation to bring these patients into the clinic or pharmacy to receive these services. There's a blue issue brief that's included in your packet, and this describes how the language could be modified to remove this barrier and achieve savings for the state in both the short term and long term. Further reductions in pharmacy payments could result in reduced access. Medicaid reimbursement has been reduced twice in the last 5 years, including cuts incurred during both the 2003 and 2005 sessions. In addition, Minnesota has become one of the most aggressive states in setting the state maximum allowable cost prices on generic drugs. The governor's proposal would further reduce pharmacy reimbursement and would, in most cases, push compensation to pharmacies below their costs to dispense the medication. This loss of revenue threatens pharmacists' ability to participate in MA and remain viable community businesses and could result in restricted access to our pharmacies. I would ask that you please stay the course in rejecting this unwarranted and unwise cut to our pharmacies. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning and welcome any questions.
Michelle, is there a second idea in here somewhere?
Let's see. I believe our second idea, may I refer to Liz Carpenter? Liz, our second, I think our generics? Yep. Madam Chair and members of the committee, we do have some recommendations by NACDS, the National Association of Chain Drug Stores. One that was particularly that comes to mind is increasing of generics. Currently, our state is at 59.3% in generic dispensing for state Medicaid patients, and by raising that by only 1%, we can generate $1.93 million in annual savings for the state. Our bordering state of Wisconsin is actually 4.1% higher than us in generic dispensing, and if we met them at that 4.1, we could actually generate a revenue of $8 million. The one with the MTM is both a short-term and a long-term benefit. The short-term benefit of removing the barrier access to MTM is that DHS will not need to pay for the transportation to get patients to a pharmacy to receive those services. And the long-term benefit is that the state is going to see decreased hospitalizations, better health care outcomes for their patients. So those are the two that I would like to highlight.
So thank you for calling that to our attention. I have just one other question, and that is, does your organization have a position on the use of the provider tax?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I don't have an answer to that. I could gladly follow up on it for you, though.
Well, you made quite a point of the fact that you pay it, so I thought maybe. Any other questions? No, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
The last person, because she also took off from work today, will be Jean Catola. Jean Catola?
Madam Chair, maybe the testifier is coming up, but just with regard to the provider tax, I would encourage you to take a further look at that, in that there's $250 million being taken from that account in order that
it's actually $398.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Lynch.
Jean Catola?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jean Catola, and I'm a parent and constituent.
Thank you for allowing me today to testify on the importance of maintaining the funding for fetal alcohol syndrome disorder prevention and services in Minnesota for the MOFAS organization. In your packets, there is a letter from the board president and some additional information that might be helpful. Imagine what it would be like to discover that your child has brain damage from fetal alcohol and you are unable to locate information because programs and resources are no longer offered. Imagine the educators, social and county workers, and those in the juvenile justice system who must work with your child but don't understand your child's special needs because the fetal alcohol spectrum disorder training programs are no longer available. Imagine your child in their late teens developing mental illnesses because interventions were never offered due to lack of resources. Now imagine your child living in an adult world unable to cope and committing crimes or suicide out of frustration and loneliness. I am the mother of a 17-year-old boy with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, and I live with these fears and frustrations every day. I can't imagine what I would have done if MOFAS, the Minnesota Organization for Fetal Alcohol Syndrome, had not been available. MOFAS provided our family with up-to-date information in order to help our son through difficult times. We not only have attended training through MOFAS, but have also received compassionate, understanding support from their staff, which gives our family a tremendous amount of hope in determining how to best help our son. Over 50,000 individuals, most of them with children, have fetal alcohol syndrome in the state of Minnesota. The number of those affected is suspected to be much higher, as this number does not include those who are not diagnosed or those who suffer from partial effects. This disability is found in every race and socioeconomic background in Minnesota. It is more prevalent than Down syndrome, spinal bifida, and cerebral palsy combined. It is estimated that it costs the state of Minnesota over $107.4 million at a minimum each year to help those with fetal alcohol syndrome. In order to truly cut costs, prevention is the key. How many more babies will be born with this horrific disability if prevention programs such as the one that MOFAS delivers to educate the public about the dangers of drinking during pregnancy are reduced? Once a child is affected prenatally, the damage is permanent. MOFAS not only educates on prevention during pregnancy, but also helps to educate professionals who work with those affected with FASD as well as with families and children. Last year, MOFAS trained 14,200 professionals across the state. Since 1997, the state funding for FASD has decreased from $6.75 million to $1.7 million. The governor's recommended cut would decrease current funding by 30%, eliminating valuable prevention and family services. While prevention is the key in eliminating FASD, once diagnosed, another type of prevention becomes important, and that is to provide the best support and assistance quickly in order to stop the secondary mental illnesses that occur by providing services to assist in identifying interventions at an early age. The funding for MOFAS is such a small investment compared to the costs that the schools, social systems, and families must bear. Our family alone in the past 3 years has spent $50,000 on services trying to help our son, and that does not include what was spent through publicly assisted programs. The reductions that have been suggested will ultimately diminish MOFAS's ability to offer key prevention-based programs. This will not be in the best interest of those who must bear the burden of this disability. Some examples of what would be affected if a reduction to FASD spending is made include the elimination of programs for teens and young adults with FAS that provides them with life skills training to equip them for a more successful adult life. Reduction of training and education for foster, adoptive, and biological parents struggling to raise children with FAS. Limitations in the ability to do outreach work in the Native American community. This work includes support and education of families with FAS. Curtailing a pilot program designed to help women's chemical dependency treatment centers that work with women and children with FAS. MOFAS is a responsible organization and prides itself in the effectiveness of its work with families, individuals, and its ability to collaborate with the medical profession, the schools, and the business community. They have a very low administrative cost and the ability to get programs in the community at a rapid pace. As a parent, I hear about the struggles and frustrations of parents from other states. I am very proud to say that due to the work of MOFAS, it has created the best network of diagnostic clinics for FASD in the country. They have successfully partnered with business to launch public awareness campaigns, and they have developed collaborations with the University of Minnesota and the Minneapolis Public Schools to provide classroom support for educators, parents, and students with FASD. Parents in other states have often said to me that they wished they had an organization like MOFAS to help them. On behalf of families and children across Minnesota who are struggling every day with FASD, we strongly urge you to maintain MOFAS's current funding level. We thank you and trust that you will continue to see the value in supporting the important work of MOFAS.
Thank you. Questions, Senator Lynch?
Madam Chair, thank you for your testimony. I just wanted to offer further comment that I received a call yesterday from Susan Carlson. And I think that this is particularly troubling in that in 1998, the state's commitment was $7 million. And we have clearly been moving in the wrong direction in this arena. And at this point, I think your comments are very much appreciated, and I would hope that I'm serving on this committee long enough to be serving in a time when we can turn some of these things around. And I could be talking about fetal alcohol syndrome or heart and stroke prevention or the diabetes epidemic or obesity. And I guess my point here is that we don't struggle in Minnesota for lack of what needs to be done, for lack of research, for lack of what the evidence in the science tells us. What we lack is the courage and the leadership.
Thank you, Senator Lynch. Other questions? Now, thank you for coming. And
thank you.
If Deborah and Sam could come back tomorrow, we will add you to that agenda. We're sorry we try to estimate about how much testimony we can take in the time we have, but we're a little off today, and I apologize for that. With that, the meeting is adjourned. So do you want to see about these two ideas?